What took him to the foot of Momiji Hill whenever he could manage it during his rest periods was an unforeseen complication. A library was to be built, and when it was, the locust tree would be moved. Matahachi guiltily supposed the musket would be uncovered, and this would link him directly to the plot. But he hadn't been able to find a time when no one was around to dig up the musket and throw it away. Even when sleeping, he'd break out in a sweat. Once he dreamed he was in the land of the dead, and wherever he looked, there were locust trees. A few nights after his confinement in the woodshed, in a vision as clear as day, he dreamed of his mother. Instead of taking pity on him, Osugi shouted angrily and threw a basket full of cocoons at him. When the cocoons rained down on his head, he tried to run away. She pursued him, her hair mysteriously transformed into white cocoons. He ran and ran, but she was always behind him. Bathed in sweat, he jumped off a cliff and began falling through the darkness of hell, falling endlessly through blackness. "Mother, forgive me!" he cried out like a hurt child, and the sound of his own voice awakened him. The reality he woke to, the prospect of death, was more terrifying than the dream. He tried the door, which was locked, as he already knew. In desperation, he climbed up a pickle barrel, broke a small window near the roof, and squeezed through. Using piles of lumber and rock and small hills of excavated dirt for cover, he made his way stealthily to the vicinity of the western rear gate. The locust tree was still there. He sighed with relief. He found a hoe and started digging as if he expected to discover his own life. Unnerved by the noise he was making, he stopped and looked all around him. Seeing no one, he began again. The fear that someone had already found the musket made him swing the hoe frantically. His breathing became rapid and uneven. Sweat and grime mixed, making him look as if he'd just come from a mud bath. He was beginning to get dizzy, but he could not stop. The blade struck something long. Casting the hoe aside, he reached down to pull it out, thinking, "I've got it!" His relief was short-lived. The object wasn't wrapped in oil paper, there was no box, and it wasn't cool like metal. He took hold, held it up, and dropped it. It was a slender white wrist bone or shin bone. Matachi did not have the heart to pick up the hoe again. It seemed like another nightmare. But he knew he was awake. He could count every leaf of the locust tree. "What would Daizo have to gain by lying?" he wondered, as he walked around the tree, kicking at the dirt. He was still circling the tree when a figure walked quietly up behind him and slapped him lightly on the back. With a loud laugh right beside Matahachi's ear, he said,
"You won't find it."
Matahachi's whole body went limp. He almost fell into the hole. Turning his head toward the voice, he stared blankly for several minutes before uttering a little croak of astonishment.
"Come with me,"
said Takuan, taking him by the hand. Matahachi could not move. His fingers went numb, and he clawed at the priest's hand. A chill of abject horror spread from his heels upward.
"Didn't you hear? Come with me,"
said Takuan, scolding with his eyes. Matahachi's tongue was almost as useless as a mute's.
This fix dirt, I...
In a pitiless tone, Takuan said,
"Leave it. It's a waste of time. The things people do on this earth, good or bad, are like ink on porous paper. They cannot be erased, not in 1,000 years. You imagine that kicking a little dirt around will undo what you've done? It's because you think like that that your life is so untidy. Now come with me. You're a criminal. Your crime, heinous. I'm going to cut off your head with a bamboo saw and cast you into the pool of blood and hell."
He seized Matahachi's earlobe and pulled him along. Takuan rapped on the door of the shed where the kitchen helpers slept.
"One of you boys come out here," he said.
A boy came out, rubbing the sleep from his eyes. When he recognized the priest he'd seen talking with the shogun, he came awake and said,
"Yes, sir. Can I do something for you?"
I want you to open that woodshed.
There's a well digger locked up in there.
He isn't in there. He's right here. There's no point in putting him back in through the window, so open the door.
The boy hastened to fetch the inspector, who rushed out, apologizing and begging Takuan not to report the matter. Takuan shoved Matachi into the shed, went inside, and closed the door. A few minutes later, he poked his head out and said,
"You must have a razor somewhere. Sharpen it and bring it here."
The inspector and the kitchen helper looked at each other, neither daring to ask the priest why he wanted the razor. Then they honed the razor and handed it over to him.
"Thanks," said Takuan. "Now you can go back to bed."
The inside of the shed was pitch black, only a glimpse of starlight being visible through the broken window. Takuan seated himself on a pile of kindling. Matachi slumped down on a reed mat, hanging his head in shame. For a long time, there was silence. Unable to see the razor, Matachi wondered nervously whether Takuan was holding it in his hand. At last, Takuan spoke.
"Matachi, what did you dig up under the locust tree?"
Silence.
"I could show you how to dig up something. It would mean extracting something from nothingness, recovering the real world from a land of dreams."
"Yes, sir."
"You haven't the least idea what the reality I'm talking about is. No doubt you are still in your world of fantasy. Well, since you're as naive as an infant, I suppose I'll have to chew your intellectual food for you. How old are you?"
28.
"The same age as Musashi."
Matachi put his hands to his face and wept. Takuan did not speak until he had cried himself out. Then he said,
"Isn't it frightening to think that the locust tree nearly became the grave marker of a fool? You were digging your own grave, actually on the verge of putting yourself into it."
Matahachi flung his arms around Takuan's legs and pleaded, "Save me! Please save me! My eyes are open now! I was taken in by Daizo of Narai."
"No, your eyes are not open. Nor did Daizo deceive you. He simply tried to make use of the biggest fool on earth, a greedy, unsophisticated, petty-minded dolt who nevertheless had the temerity to take on a task any sensible man would shrink from."
"Yes, yes, I was a fool."
"Just who do you think this Daizo was?"
"I don't know."
"His real name is Mizoguchi Shinano. He was a retainer of Otani Yoshitsugu, who is a close friend of Ishida Mitsunari. Mitsunari, you will remember, was one of the losers at Sekigahara."
No, gasped Matahachi. "He's one of the warriors the shogunate is trying to track down?
What else would a man out to assassinate the shogun be? Your stupidity is appalling."
"He didn't tell me that. He just said he hated the Tokugawas. He thought it'd be better for the country if the Toyotomis were in power. He was talking about working for the sake of everybody."
"You didn't bother to ask yourself who he really was, did you? Without once using your head, you went boldly about the business of digging your own grave. Your kind of courage is frightening, Matahachi."
"What am I to do?"
"Do?
Please, Takuan, please, help me."
"Let go of me."
But I didn't actually use the gun. I didn't even find it."
"Of course you didn't. It didn't arrive on time. If Jotaro, whom Daizo duped into becoming a part of this dreadful plot, had reached Edo as planned, the musket might very well have been buried under the tree."
"Jotaro? You mean the boy?"
"Never mind. That doesn't concern you. What does concern you is the crime of treason, which you have committed and which cannot be pardoned. Nor can it be condoned by the gods and the Buddha. You may as well stop thinking about being saved."
"Isn't there any way?"
"Certainly not."
"Have mercy," sobbed Matahachi, clinging to Takuan's knees. Takuan stood up and kicked him away.
Idiot!
He shouted in a voice that threatened to lift the roof off the shed. The ferocity of his glare was beyond description. A Buddha refusing to be clung to, a terrifying Buddha unwilling to save even the penitent. For a second or two, Matachi met the look resentfully. Then his head dropped in resignation, and his body was racked with sobs. Takuan took the razor from the top of the woodpile and touched Matachi's head with it lightly.
As long as you're going to die, you may as well die looking like a disciple of the Buddha. Out of friendship, I'll help you do that. Close your eyes and sit quietly with your legs crossed. The line between life and death is not thicker than an eyelid. There is nothing frightening about death, nothing to cry over. Don't weep, child. Don't weep. Takuan will prepare you for the end.
The room where the shogun's council of elders met to discuss matters of state was isolated from other parts of Edo Castle. This secret chamber was completely enclosed by other rooms and hallways. Whenever it was necessary to receive a decision from the shogun, the ministers would either go to his audience chamber or send a petition in a lacquered box. Notes and replies had been going back and forth with unusual frequency, and Takuan and Lord Hojo had been admitted to the room several times, often remaining there for day-long deliberations. On this particular day, in another room, less isolated but no less well-guarded, the ministers had heard the report of the envoy sent to Kiso. He said that though there had been no delay in acting on the order of Daizo's arrest, Daizo had escaped after closing up his establishment in Narai, taking his entire household with him. A search had brought to light a substantial supply of arms and ammunition, together with a few documents that had escaped destruction. The papers included letters to and from Toyotomi supporters in Osaka. The envoy had arranged for shipment of the evidence to the shogun's capital and then rushed back to Edo by fast horse. The ministers felt like fishermen who had cast a big net and not caught so much as a single minnow. The very next day, a retainer of Lord Sakai, who was a member of the Council of Elders, made a report of a different sort. In accordance with your lordship's instructions, Miyamoto Musashi has been released from prison. He was handed over to a man named Musou Gonnosuke, to whom we explained in detail how the misunderstanding came about. Lord Sakai promptly informed Takuan, who said lightly,
"Very good of you.
Please ask your friend Musashi not to think too badly of us," said Lord Sakai apologetically, uncomfortably aware of the error made in the territory under his jurisdiction. One of the problems solved most quickly was that of Daizo's base of operations in Edo. Officials under the Commissioner of Edo descended on the pawn shop in Shibaura and in one swift move confiscated everything, both property and secret documents. In the process, the unlucky Akemi was taken into custody, though she was completely in the dark regarding her patron's treacherous plans. Received an audience by the shogun one evening, Takuan related events as he knew them and told him how everything had turned out. He ended by saying,
"Please do not forget for a moment that there are many more Daizos of Narai in this world."
Hidetada accepted the warning with a vigorous nod.
"If you attempt to search out all such men and bring them to justice," Takuan continued, "all your time and effort will be consumed in coping with insurgents. You won't be able to carry out the great work expected of you as your father's successor."
The shogun perceived the truth of Takuan's words and took them to heart. "Let the punishments be light," he directed. "Since you reported the conspiracy, I leave it to you to decide the penalties." After expressing his heartfelt thanks, Takuan said,
"Quite without intending to, I see I've been here at the castle for more than a month. It's time to leave now.
I'll go to Koyagyu in Yamato to visit Lord Sekishusai. Then I'll return to the Daitokuji, traveling by way of the Senshu district.
Mention of Sekishusai seemed to evoke a pleasant memory for Hidetada. How is old Yagyu's health? He asked.
Unfortunately, I'm told that Lord Munenori thinks the end is near.
Hidetada recalled a time when he had been at the Shokokuji encampment and Sekishusai had been received by Ieyasu. Hidetada had been a child at the time, and Sekishusai's manly bearing had made a deep impression on him.
Takuan broke the silence.
There is one other matter, he said. In consultation with the Council of Elders and with their permission, Lord Hojo of Awa and I have recommended a samurai by the name of Miyamoto Musashi to be a tutor in Your Excellency's household. I hope that you will look favorably upon this recommendation.
I've been informed of that. It's said that the House of Hosokawa is interested in him, which is very much to his favor. I have decided it would be all right to appoint one more tutor.
It was a day or two before Takuan left the castle, and in the time he acquired a new disciple. Going to the woodshed behind the inspector's office, he had one of the kitchen helpers open the door for him, letting the light fall on a freshly shaven head. Temporarily blinded, the novice, who thought himself a condemned man, slowly lifted his downcast eyes and said,
"Ah!" "Come," said Takuan.
Wearing the priest's robe Takuan had sent him, Matahachi stood up unsteadily on legs that felt as if they had begun to decay. Takuan gently put his arm around him and helped him out of the shed. The day of retribution had arrived. Behind his eyelids, closed in resignation, Matahachi could see the reed mat on which he would be forced to kneel before the executioner raised his sword. Apparently, he had forgotten that traitors faced an ignominious death by hanging. Tears trickled down his clean-shaven cheeks.
"Can you walk?" asked Takuan.
Matahachi thought he was replying. In fact, no sound came out. He was barely conscious of going through the castle gates and crossing the bridges spanning the inner and outer moats. Trudging along dolefully beside Takuan, he was the perfect image of the proverbial sheep being led to slaughter.
"Hail to the Buddha Amida! Hail to the Buddha Amida!"
Silently, he repeated the invocation to the Buddha of Eternal Light. Matahachi squinted and looked beyond the outer moat at stately daimyo mansions. Farther to the east lay Hibiya Village. Beyond, the streets of the downtown district were visible. The floating world called out to him anew, and along with his yearning for it, fresh tears came to his eyes. He closed them and rapidly repeated,
"Hail to the Buddha Amida! Hail to the Buddha Amida!"
The supplication became first audible, then louder and louder, faster and faster.
"Hurry up!"
Takuan said sternly. From the moat, they turned toward Otemachi and cut diagonally across a large vacant lot. Matahachi felt he had walked 1,000 miles already. Would the road simply go on like this, all the way to hell, daylight gradually giving way to utter darkness?
"Wait here," commanded Takuan.
They were in the middle of a flat open area. To the left, muddy water came down the moat from Tokiwa Bridge. Directly across the street was an earthen wall, only recently covered with white plaster. Beyond this was the stockade of the new prison and a group of black buildings, which looked like ordinary townhouses, but was actually the official residence of the Commissioner of Edo. His legs quaking, Matachi could no longer support himself. He plopped down on the ground. Somewhere in the grass, the cry of a quail suggested the pathway to the land of the dead.
"Run for it?"
His feet were not bound, nor were his hands. But no, he thought. He couldn't get away with it. If the shogun decided he was worth finding, there would not be a leaf, a blade of grass, to hide behind.
In his heart, he cried out to his mother, who at this moment seemed very dear to him. If only he had never left her side, he wouldn't be here now. He recalled other women, too, Oko, Akemi, Otsu, others he had been fond of or dallied with. But his mother was the only woman he genuinely longed to see. If only he were given the opportunity to go on living, he was certain he would never again go against her will, never again be an unfilial son. He felt a damp chill on the back of his neck. He looked up at three wild geese winging their way toward the bay and envied them. The urge to take flight was like an itch. And why not? He had nothing to lose. If he were caught, he would be no worse off than he was now. With a desperate look in his eyes, he glanced toward the gate across the street. No sign of Takuan. He jumped up and started to run. Stop! The loud voice alone was enough to break his spirit. He looked around and saw one of the commissioner's executioners. The man stepped forward and brought his long staff down on Matahachi's shoulder, felling him with one blow, then pinned him down with the staff, as a child might pin down a frog with a stick. When Takuan came out of the commissioner's residence, he was accompanied by several guards, including a captain. They led out another prisoner who was tied up with a rope. The captain selected the place where the punishment would be carried out, and two freshly woven reed mats were spread on the ground.
"Shall we get on with it?"
he asked Takuan, who nodded his assent. As captain and priest sat down on stools to watch, the executioner shouted, "Stand up!" and lifted his staff. Matahachi dragged himself to his feet, but was too weak to walk. The executioner seized him angrily by the back of his robe and half-dragged him to one of the mats. He sat. His head dropped. He could no longer hear the quail. Though he was conscious of voices, they sounded indistinct, as though separated from him by a wall. Hearing his name whispered, he looked up in surprise.
"Akemi!" he gasped. "What are you doing here?"
She was kneeling on the other mat.
"No talking!"
Two of the guards made use of their staffs to separate them. The captain stood up and began reading the official judgments and sentences in stern, dignified tones. Akemi held back her tears, but Matahachi wept shamelessly. The captain finished, sat down, and shouted,
"Strike!"
Two low-ranking guards carrying long switches of split bamboo pranced into position and began systematically lashing the prisoners across the back.
"One, two, three,"
they counted. Matahachi moaned. Akemi, head bowed and face ashen, clamped her teeth together with all her might in an effort to bear the pain.
"Seven, eight, nine,"
the switches frayed. Smoke seemed to rise from their tips. A few passers-by stopped at the edge of the lot to watch. "What's going on?"
"Two prisoners being punished, it looks like. 100 lashes, probably.
They're not even to 50 yet."
"Must hurt."
A guard approached and startled them by thumping the ground sharply with his staff.
"Off with you! You're not allowed to stand here."
The gawkers moved to a safer distance and, looking back, saw that the punishment was over. The guards discarded their switches, which were now only bundles of flabby strands, and wiped the sweat off their faces. Takuan stood up. The captain was already on his feet. They exchanged amenities, and the captain led his men back toward the commissioner's compound. Takuan stood still for several minutes, looking at the bowed figures on the mats. He said nothing before walking away. The shogun had bestowed a number of gifts on him. These he had donated to various Zen temples in the city. Yet the gossips of Edo were soon at it again. According to which rumor one heard, he was an ambitious priest who meddled in politics, or one the Tokugawas had persuaded to spy on the Osaka faction, or a black-robed conspirator. The rumors meant nothing to Takuan. Though he cared very much about the welfare of the nation, it made little difference to him whether the gaudy flowers of the time, the castles at Edo and Osaka, blossomed or fell. A few thin rays of sunlight filtered through the clouds. The voice of the quail was audible again. Neither of the forms moved for quite some time, though neither had completely lost consciousness. Finally, Akemi mumbled,
"Matachi, look, water!"
Before them were two wooden pails of water, each with a dipper, placed there as evidence that the office of the commissioner was not entirely heartless. After gulping down several mouthfuls, Akemi offered the dipper to Matachi. When he failed to respond, she asked,
"What's the matter? Don't you want any?"
Slowly he reached out and took the dipper. Once it touched his lips, he drank ravenously.
"Matachi, have you become a priest?"
"Huh? Is that all?"
"Is what all?"
"Is the punishment over? They haven't cut off our heads yet."
"They weren't supposed to. Didn't you hear the man read the sentences?"
"What did he say?"
"He said we were to be banished from Edo."
"I'm alive!" he shrieked.
Almost insane with joy, he jumped up and walked away without so much as a backward glance at Akemi. She put her hands to her head and began to fuss with her hair. Then she adjusted her kimono and tightened her obi.
"Shameless,"
she muttered through crooked lips. Matahachi was only a speck on the horizon. The Challenge. Iori was bored after only a few days at the Hojo residence. There was nothing to do but play.
"When's Takuan coming back?"
he asked Shinzo one morning, really wanting to know what had happened to Musashi.
"My father is still at the castle, so I suppose Takuan is too," said Shinzo. "They'll be back sooner or later. Why don't you amuse yourself with the horses?"
Iori raced to the stable and threw a lacquer and mother-of-pearl saddle on his favorite steed. He had ridden the horse both the day before and the day before that without telling Shinzo. Receiving permission made him feel proud. He mounted and tore out the back gate at full gallop. The houses of daimyo, the paths through the fields, the rice paddies, the forests, the sights came at him in rapid succession and were left behind just as rapidly. Bright red snake gourds and russet grass proclaimed that autumn was at its height. The Chichibu Range rose beyond Musashino Plain.
"He's in those mountains somewhere," thought Iori.
He envisioned his beloved master in jail, and the tears on his cheeks made the wind feel soothingly cool.
Why not go see Musashi?
Without giving the matter further thought, he whipped the horse, and horse and rider surged through the silvery sea of fluffy eulalia. After covering a mile at breakneck speed, he reined in the horse, thinking,
maybe he's gone back to the house.
He found the new house finished, but unlived in. At the nearest paddy, he called out to the farmers harvesting their rice,
"Has anyone seen my teacher?"
They shook their heads sadly in reply. Then it had to be Chichibu. On horseback, he could make the journey in a day. After a time, he came to the village of Nobidome. The entrance to the village was virtually blocked by samurai's mounts, pack horses, traveling chests, palanquins, and between 40 and 50 samurai having their lunch. He turned around to look for a way around the village. 3 or 4 samurai's attendants came running after him.
"Hey, you rascal, wait!"
"What, you calling me?"
Iori asked angrily.
"Off the horse!"
They were on either side of him now.
"Why? I don't even know you."
"Just keep your mouth shut and get off."
"No, you can't make me."
Before he knew what was happening, one of the men lifted Iori's right leg high in the air, tumbling him off the other side of the horse.
"Someone wants to see you. Come along with me."
He took hold of Iori's collar and pulled him toward a roadside tea house. Osugi stood outside, a cane in one hand. With a wave of her other hand, she dismissed the attendants. She was dressed for traveling and in the company of all those samurai. Iori didn't know what to make of it, nor did he have time to give it much thought.
"Brat!" said Osugi.
Then she whacked him across the shoulder with her cane. He went through the motions of taking a stance, though he knew he was hopelessly outnumbered.
"Musashi has only the best of disciples. Ha! I hear you're one of them."
I wouldn't say things like that if I were you."
"Oh, wouldn't you know?
I don't have any business with you."
"Oh, yes you do. You're going to tell us a few things. Who sent you to follow us?"
"Follow you?" Iori asked with a snort of disdain.
"How dare you talk that way?" the old woman screeched. "Hasn't Musashi taught you any manners?"
"I don't need any lessons from you. I'm leaving."
"No, you aren't," cried Osugi
as she caught him on the shin with her cane.
"Ow!"
Iori collapsed to the ground. Attendants grabbed the boy and marched him over to the miller's shop by the village gate, where sat a samurai of obviously high rank. He had finished eating and was sipping hot water. Seeing Iori's predicament, he broke into a grin. "Dangerous," thought the boy, as his eyes met Kojiro's. With a look of triumph, Osugi thrust out her chin and said,
"See? Just as I thought. It was Iori. What's Musashi got up his sleeve now? Who else could have sent him to follow us?"
"Hmm," mumbled Kojiro, nodding and dismissing his attendants, one of whom asked if he wanted the boy tied up. Kojiro smiled and shook his head. Held by Kojiro's eyes, Iori was unable to stand straight, let alone run away. Kojiro said, "You heard what she said. Is it true?"
"No, I just came out for a ride. I wasn't following you or anybody else."
"Hmm, could be.
If Musashi's any kind of samurai, he wouldn't resort to cheap tricks."
Then he began thinking out loud.
"On the other hand, if he heard we'd suddenly left on a trip with a contingent of Hosokawa samurai, he might get suspicious and send someone to check on our movements. It would only be natural."
The change in Kojiro's circumstances was striking. Instead of the forelock, his head was shaved in proper samurai fashion, and in place of the loud clothing he used to wear, he had on a solid black kimono, which together with his rustic hakama made a most conservative impression. The drying pole he now carried at his side. His hope of becoming a vassal in the house of Hosokawa had been realized, not for the 5,000 bushels he had wanted, but for a stipend about half that large. The present entourage, under the command of Kakube, was an advanced party on the way to Buzen to make things ready for Hosokawa Tadatoshi's return. With his father's age foremost in his mind, he had submitted his request to the shogunate quite some time earlier. Permission had finally been granted, an indication that the shogunate had no qualms about the Hosokawa's loyalty. Osugi had asked to come along because she felt it imperative to return home. She had not relinquished her position as head of the family, yet she had been absent for nearly 10 years. Uncle Gon might have looked after things for her if he were still alive. As it was, she suspected there were a number of family matters awaiting her attention. They would be going through Osaka, where she had left Uncle Gon's ashes. She would be able to carry them to Mimasaka and hold a memorial service. It had been a long time, too, since she'd held a service for her neglected ancestors. She could return to her quest after she had straightened out affairs at home. Recently, she'd felt pleased with herself, believing she had struck a strong blow against Musashi. On first hearing of his recommendation from Kojiro, she had fallen into a state of extreme depression. If Musashi were to receive the appointment, he would be that much farther from her reach. She'd taken it upon herself to prevent this disaster to the shogunate and the nation from happening. She hadn't seen Takuan, but she visited the house of Yagyu as well as the house of Hojo, denouncing Musashi, claiming that it would be a dangerous folly to raise him to a high station. Not content with that, she reiterated her calumnies at the house of every government minister whose servants allowed her through the gate. Kojiro, of course, made no effort to stop her, but he offered no special encouragement either, knowing that she wouldn't rest until she had done a thorough job. And thorough it was. She even wrote malicious letters about Musashi's past and threw them into the compounds of the Commissioner of Edo and the members of the Council of Elders. Before she was done, even Kojiro wondered if she hadn't gone too far. Kojiro encouraged Osugi to make the journey, believing it would be better for him if she was back in the country where she could do a minimum of harm. If Osugi had any regret, it was only that Matahachi was not going with her, for she was still convinced that someday he would see the light and return to her. Iori had no way of knowing the circumstances. Unable to flee, loath to cry for fear it would discredit Musashi, he felt trapped among enemies. Deliberately, Kojiro stared directly into the boy's eyes, and to his surprise, found his stare returned. Not once did Iori's eyes waver.
"Do you have brush and ink?"
Kojiro asked Osugi.
"Yes, but the ink's all dried up. Why?"
"I want to write a letter. The signs Yajibe's men put up didn't draw Musashi out, and I don't know where he is. Iori is the best messenger one could ask for. I think I should send Musashi a note on the occasion of my departure from Edo."
"What are you going to write?"
"Nothing elaborate. I'll tell him to practice his swordsmanship and visit me in Buzen one of these days. I'll let him know I'm willing to wait the rest of my life. He can come whenever he has the necessary confidence."
Osugi threw up her hands in horror.
"How can you talk like that? The rest of your life? Indeed! I haven't got that much time to wait. I must see Musashi dead within the next 2 or 3 years at most."
"Leave it to me. I'll take care of your problem at the same time I take care of mine."
"Can't you see I'm getting old? It has to be done while I'm still alive."
"If you look after yourself, you'll be around when my invincible sword does its work."
Kojiro took the writing kit and walked to a nearby stream where he wet his finger to moisten the ink stick. Still standing, he took some paper from his kimono. He wrote quickly, but both his calligraphy and his composition were those of an expert.
"You can use this for paste," said Osugi,
taking a few grains of cooked rice and placing them on a leaf.
Kojiro mashed them between his fingers, spread the stuff along the edge of the letter, and sealed it. On the back he wrote, "From Sasaki Gandyu, retainer to the house of Hosokawa. Come here, you. I'm not going to hurt you. I want you to take this letter to Musashi. Make sure he gets it, because it's important."
Iori hung back a minute, but then grunted his assent and snatched the letter from Kojiro's hand.
"What's written in it?"
"Just what I told the old lady."
"May I look at it?"
"You aren't to break the seal."
"If you wrote something insulting, I won't take it."
"There's nothing rude in it. I asked him to remember our promise for the future, and told him I look forward to seeing him again, perhaps in Buzen, if he should happen to come there."
"What do you mean by seeing him again?"
"I mean meeting him on the boundary between life and death."
Kojiro's cheeks reddened slightly.
Stuffing the letter into his kimono, Iori said, "All right, I'll deliver it," and ran off.
About 30 yards away, he stopped, turned, and stuck out his tongue at Osugi.
"Crazy old witch!"
he shouted.
"What?"
She was ready to go after him, but Kojiro took her arm and held her back.
"Let it pass,"
he said with a rueful smile.
"He's only a child."
Then to Iori he shouted,
"Don't you have anything better to say?"
No!
Tears of anger rose from his chest.
You'll be sorry, though. There isn't any way Musashi could lose to the likes of you. Just like him, aren't you? Never say die. But I like the way you stick up for him. If he ever dies, come to me. I'll put you to work sweeping the garden or something.
Not knowing Kojiro was only teasing, Iori was insulted to the marrow. He picked up a rock. When he raised his arm to throw it, Kojiro fixed his eyes on him.
Don't do that,
he said in a calm but forceful voice. Iori, feeling the eyes had hit him like two bullets, dropped the stone and ran. He ran on and on until, completely exhausted, he collapsed in the middle of Musashino Plain. He sat there for 2 hours, thinking about the man he looked up to as his teacher. Though he knew Musashi had many enemies, he thought of him as a great man and wanted to become a great man himself. Believing he had to do something to fulfill his obligations to his master and ensure his safety, he resolved to develop his own strength as quickly as possible. Then the memory of the terrifying light in Kojiro's eyes came back to haunt him. Wondering whether Musashi could defeat a man that strong, he pessimistically decided even his master would have to study and practice harder. He got to his feet. The white mist rolling down from the mountains spread over the plain. Deciding he should go on to Chichibu and deliver Kojiro's letter, he suddenly remembered the horse. Fearing bandits might have got hold of it, he searched frantically, calling and whistling at every other step. He seemed to hear the sound of hooves coming from the direction of what he took to be a pond. He ran toward it, but there was no horse, no pond. The shimmering mist receded into the distance. Seeing a moving black object, he approached it. A wild boar stopped rooting for food and charged dangerously close to him. The boar was swallowed up in the reeds, and in its wake the mist formed a white line, looking as if it had been spread by a magician's wand. As he gazed at it, he became conscious of gurgling water. Going closer, he saw the reflection of the moon in a rocky brook. He had always been sensitive to the mysteries of the open plain. He firmly believed that the tiniest ladybird possessed the spiritual power of the gods. In his eyes, nothing was without a soul, neither fluttering leaves, nor beckoning water, nor driving wind. Surrounded now by nature, he experienced the tremulous loneliness of autumn, nearly gone, the sad wistfulness that must be felt by grasses and insects and water. He sobbed so hard his shoulders shook, sweet tears, not bitter ones. If some being other than a human, a star perhaps, or the spirit of the plain, had asked him why he was weeping, he wouldn't have been able to say. If the inquiring spirit had persisted, soothing and coaxing him, he might finally have said, "I often cry when I'm out in the open. I always have the feeling the house in the Hotengahara is somewhere near." Crying was refreshment for his soul. After he had cried to his heart's content, heaven and earth would comfort him. When the tears were dry, his spirit would come forth from the clouds, clean and fresh.
"That's Iori, isn't it?"
"I believe it is." Iori turned toward the voices and the two human figures standing out blackly against the evening sky.
"Sensei!" cried Iori, stumbling as he ran toward the man on horseback. "It's you!"
Beside himself with joy, he clung to the stirrup and looked up to make sure he wasn't dreaming.
"What happened?" asked Musashi. "What are you doing out here alone?"
Musashi's face seemed to be very thin. Was it the moonlight? But the warmth of the voice was what Iori had hungered for weeks to hear.
"I thought I'd go to Chichibu."
The saddle caught Iori's eye.
"Why, this is the horse I was riding."
Gonnosuke, laughing, said,
"Is it yours?"
"Yes."
"We didn't know who it belonged to. It was wandering around near the Iruma River, so I regarded it as a gift from heaven to Musashi."
"The god of the plain must have sent the horse to meet you," said Iori with perfect sincerity.
"Your horse, you say? That saddle couldn't belong to a samurai getting less than 5,000 bushels.
Well, it's really Shinzo's."
Dismounting, Musashi said, "You've been staying at his house, then?"
"Yes, Takuan took me there."
"What about our new house?"
"It's finished."
"Good. We can go back there."
"Sensei."
"Yes?"
"You're so thin. Why is that?"
"I've spent quite a bit of time meditating."
"How did you get out of prison?"
"You can hear about it from Gonnosuke later. For now, let's say the gods were on my side."
"You don't have to worry anymore, Iori," said Gonnosuke. "No one has any doubts about his innocence."
Relieved, Iori became quite talkative, telling them about his meeting with Jotaro and Jotaro's going to Edo. When he came to the repulsive old woman who had showed up at the Hojo mansion, he remembered Kojiro's letter.
"Oh, I forgot something important,"
he exclaimed, and handed the letter to Musashi.
"A letter from Kojiro?"
Surprised, he held it in his hand for a moment, as though it were a missive from a long-lost friend.
"Where did you see him?"
he asked.
"At the village of Nobidome. That mean old woman was with him. He said he was going to Buzen."
"Oh?"
"He was with a lot of Hosokawa samurai. Sensei, you better be on your toes and not take any chances."
Musashi stuffed the unopened letter into his kimono and nodded. Not certain his meaning had got through, Iori said,
"That Kojiro's very strong, isn't he? Has he got something against you?"
He related to Musashi every detail of his encounter with the enemy. When they reached the cabin, Iori went down to the bottom of the hill to get food, and Gonnosuke gathered wood and fetched water. They sat down around the fire burning brightly in the hearth, and savored the pleasure of seeing each other safe and sound again. It was then that Iori noticed the fresh scars and bruises on Musashi's arms and neck.
"How did you get all those marks?" he asked. "You're covered with them."
"It's nothing important. Did you feed the horse?"
"Yes, sir."
"Tomorrow you must return it."
Early the next morning, Iori mounted the horse and galloped off for a short ride before breakfast. When the sun was above the horizon, he brought the horse to a halt and gaped in awe. Racing back to the cabin, he yelled,
"Sensei, get up, quick! It's like when we saw it from the mountain in Chichibu. The sun, it's huge, and it looks like it's going to roll over the plain. Get up, Gonnosuke!"
"Good morning,"
said Musashi from the grove where he was taking a stroll. Too excited to think about breakfast, Iori said,
"I'm going now,"
and rode off. Musashi watched as boy and horse took on the semblance of a crow at the very center of the sun. The black spot grew smaller and smaller, until at last it was absorbed by the great flaming orb. The Gateway to Glory. Before sitting down to breakfast, the gateman raked the garden, set fire to the leaves, and opened the gate. Shinzo had been up for some time, too. He started his day as he always did, by reading a selection from the Chinese classics. This was followed by sword practice. From the well, where he'd gone to wash, he walked to the stable to have a look at the horses.
"Groom," he called.
"Yes, sir?"
"Isn't the chestnut roan back yet?"
"No, but it isn't the horse I'm worried about so much as the boy."
"Don't worry about Iori. He grew up in the country. He can take care of himself."
The elderly gateman came up to Shinzo and informed him that some men had come to see him and were waiting in the garden. Walking toward the house, Shinzo waved, and as he came up to them, one man said,
"It's been a long time."
"It's good to see you all together again," said Shinzo.
"How's your health?"
"Splendid, as you can see."
"We heard you'd been wounded."
"It didn't amount to much. What brings you here at this early hour?"
"There's a little matter we'd like to talk over with you."
the five former students of Obata Kagenori, all handsome sons of banner guards or Confucian scholars, exchanged significant glances.
"Let's go over there," said Shinzo,
indicating a maple-covered hillock in one corner of the garden. Coming to the gateman's fire, they stopped and stood around it. Shinzo put his hand to his neck, then, noticing the others were looking at him, said,
"When it's cold, it does ache a little."
They took turns examining the scar.
"I heard that was the work of Sasaki Kojiro."
There was a short, tense silence.
"As it happens, our purpose in coming today was to talk about Kojiro. Yesterday we learned he was the man who killed Yogoro."
"I suspected that.
Do you have any proof?" "Circumstantial, but convincing. Yogoro's body was found at the bottom of Isarago Hill, behind the temple. Kakube's house is halfway up the hill. Kojiro was living there."
I wouldn't be surprised if Yogoro went alone to see Kojiro."
"We're pretty sure that's what happened. 3 or 4 nights before the body was found, a florist saw a man answering to Yogoro's description climbing the hill. Kojiro must have killed him and carried the body down the hill."
The 6 men stared solemnly at each other, their eyes reflecting their silent anger. Shinzo, his face reddened by the fire, asked,
"Is that all?"
"No. We wanted to talk about the future of the House of Obata and how we're going to take care of Kojiro."
Shinzo stood, lost in thought. The man who had spoken first said,
"You may have heard this already. Kojiro's become a vassal of Lord Hosokawa Tadatoshi. He's on his way to Buzen now, and he hasn't paid for what he did. Ruin our master's reputation, kill his only son and heir, and slaughter our comrades."
"Shinzo,"
urged the third man,
"as disciples of Obata Kagenori, we have to do something."
Bits of white ash drifted up from the fire. One man caught a whiff of smoke and coughed. After listening to them for a few minutes, as they expressed their bitter indignation, Shinzo said,
"I'm one of the victims, of course, and I have a plan of my own. But tell me just what you have in mind."
"We're thinking of lodging a protest with Lord Hosokawa. We'll tell him the whole story and ask that Kojiro be turned over to us."
"Then what?"
"We'll see his head up on a pike in front of the graves of our teacher and his son."
"You might be able to do that if he were turned over to you tied up.
But the Hosokawas aren't likely to do that. Even though he's only recently been engaged, he is their vassal, and it's his skill they're interested in. Your complaint would only be taken as further proof of his ability. What daimyo's going to turn over one of his vassals to anyone without compelling reasons?"
"Then we'll have to take extreme measures."
"Such as?"
"The group he's traveling with is fairly large. We could easily catch up with them. With you as our leader, the 6 of us and other loyal disciples, are you suggesting attacking him?"
"Yes.
Go with us, Shinzo."
"I don't like it."
"Aren't you the one who's been chosen to carry on the Obata name?"
"Admitting an enemy is better than we are is difficult," Shinzo said thoughtfully.
"Still, objectively, Kojiro's the better swordsman. Even with dozens of men, I'm afraid we'd only end up adding to our shame."
"You're going to stand by and do nothing?" asked one man indignantly.
"No, I resent Kojiro's getting away with what he's done as much as any of you, but I'm willing to wait until the time is right."
"You're awfully patient," one man said sarcastically.
"Aren't you evading your responsibility?" asked another.
When Shinzo made no reply, the 5 men decided further talk was useless and departed in haste. On the way, they passed Iori, who had dismounted at the gate and was leading the horse to the stable. After tying the animal up, he saw Shinzo by the fire and went to join him.
"Oh, so you're back," said Shinzo.
"Yes," said Iori. "Say, did you have a quarrel?"
"Why do you ask?"
When I came in just now, I passed some samurai. They seemed angry. They were saying strange things like, I overestimated him, and he's a weakling.
That doesn't mean anything, said Shinzo with a little laugh. Come closer and warm yourself.
Who needs a fire? I rode all the way from Musashino without stopping.
You seem in good spirits. Where did you stay last night?
At the house. Sensei's back.
I heard he was, or soon would be.
You already knew?
Takuan told me. Iori, have you heard the news?
What news?
Your teacher's going to be a great man. It's a wonderful stroke of luck for him. He's going to be one of the shogun's teachers. He'll be the founder of his own school of swordsmanship.
Do you mean that?
Does it make you happy?
Of course! Happier than anything! Can I borrow the horse?
Now? You just came back.
I'll go and tell him.
You don't have to do that. Before the day's out, the Council of Elders will issue a formal summons. As soon as we receive word, I'll go myself and tell Musashi.
Will he come here?
Yes, Shinzo assured him.
With a last look at the dying fire, he started toward the house, cheered a bit by Iori, but worried about the fate of his angry friends. The summons was not long in coming. A messenger arrived about 2 hours later with a letter for Takuan and an order for Musashi to appear the following day at the reception pavilion just outside Wadakura Gate. After his appointment was confirmed, he would be received in audience by the shogun. When Shinzo, with an attendant, reached the house on Musashino Plain, he found Musashi sitting in the sun with a kitten on his lap, talking with Gonnosuke. Words were few. Shinzo said only,
I've come for you.
Thanks, said Musashi. I was about to call you to thank you for looking after Iori. Without further ado, he mounted the horse Shinzo had brought along for him, and they returned to Ushigome. That evening, as he sat with Takuan and Lord Ujikatsu, he felt immensely fortunate to be able to regard these men, as well as Shinzo, as true friends. In the morning, Musashi awoke to find clothes suitable to the occasion already laid out for him, together with such things as a fan and tissue paper. And at breakfast, Lord Ujikatsu said to him,
"It's a great day. You should rejoice."
The meal included rice with red beans, a whole sea bream for each person, and other dishes served only on festive occasions. The menu was very much as it would have been for a coming-of-age ceremony in the Hojo family. Musashi wanted to refuse the appointment. In Chichibu, he had reconsidered his 2 years in Hotengahara and his ambition to put his swordsmanship to work in the interest of good government. Now the belief that Edo, not to speak of the rest of the country, was ready for the type of ideal government he envisioned seemed less tenable. The sanctity of the way and the application of the principles of swordsmanship for the sake of peace seemed no more than lofty ideals, at least until either Edo or Osaka succeeded in consolidating its rule over the whole country. And he hadn't made up his mind on another point. If the final battle were to come tomorrow, should he support the Eastern Army or the Western Army? Or should he leave the world behind and survive on mountain grasses until peace was restored? Even on this morning, he could not escape the feeling that if he contented himself with a high position, his pursuit of the way would be aborted. But he couldn't refuse. What finally swayed him was the trust in him shown by his supporters. There was no way to say no. He could not break faith with Takuan, his old friend and stern mentor, and Lord Ujikatsu, now a valued acquaintance. Dressed in formal attire and riding a splendid horse with a beautiful saddle, he set forth on a brilliantly sunlit road for the castle, each step supposedly carrying him closer to the gateway to glory. In front of the reception pavilion was a graveled courtyard and, on a high post, a sign saying, "Dismount." As Musashi got off the horse, an official and one of the stablemen came forward.
"My name is Miyamoto Musashi," he announced in a formal tone of voice. "I have come in response to a summons issued yesterday."